Well, Russ and I recently had the pleasure of not only attending the always celebratory Paul W. Smith St. Patrick's Day celebration, but also sitting down in the Fisher Building with widely read and highly respected Detroit Free Press auto critic and, I might add, proud Spartan alumnus Mark Phelan to chat about the state of the auto industry and a bit later in the interview, the state of journalism so much under siege these days. Mark, first, thanks for your time and so good to finally do an interview in person.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for being here, and it's great to be in the Fisher Building. This place is a treasure.
Yeah, it's the iconic Golden Tower of the Fisher Building, WJR. Mark, at the end of 2018, you wrote a fairly lengthy and very thoughtful piece, I thought, looking back at 2018 in the industry, and then also ahead to some of the challenges and opportunities for 2019. Let's start with the look back at 2018. A lot of cars sold, but some ambiguity.
Absolutely. Things are changing. We've been on an upswing for the last several years. The market has plateaued at least, and the expectation is that this year is going to be down a few hundred thousand units. That's not enough to, cause any automaker great stress, but it's a change from the days when they could build everything that they built, they sold.
Well, and you mentioned in the piece, too, despite all the sales, and typically, historically, the industry would be very happy, but they were faced with some rather tough decisions to make with regard to plant closings.
Plant closings and restructuring in general. We've seen a time of very healthy profits and also layoffs of both, factory workers and white-collar workers, which is an almost unprecedented combination in the auto industry. And it's because the type of vehicles people are buying has changed pretty drastically and pretty quickly. And also, there's so much emphasis on developing new autonomous and electric vehicles that a lot of that they're hiring new people and letting some people who have the skills that had been vital in the past, but perhaps they don't need as much of, go. It's very stressful for a lot of people.
So all in all, 2018, great sales, restructuring, plant closing. It's kind of a mixed bag.
Very much so, and we're going to see more of the same in the rest of 2019, I think. Ford just began its first round of white-collar layoffs. We all knew that was going to come when they announced $11 billion worth of restructuring over the next few years, but they hadn't said anything about the when and where, and the who is still up in the air. So these are nervous times for a lot of people in the auto industry, especially those in Dearborn.
Now, in terms of projected sales for 2019, I mean, the auto industry's been on a pretty good run here. Where do you see sales going?
I think we'll be down maybe 300,000 or 400,000 units from last year, which that will keep people from being happy, but it shouldn't throw anybody into deep losses. It's the kind of thing that you can take care of with a couple of shifts, and if you're building the right vehicles, you may see an increase. Thus far, it's early, but it does look like sales are going to be down a bit.
Well, you anticipated my next question. You said the right vehicles. Looks like some of the sedans are going by way of history here, and SUVs, trucks, and electric vehicles. I mean, where is it going in terms of the types of cars people want to buy?
First and foremost, it's going away from sedans. Unless you're a Toyota, Honda, or Nissan, there's really not much point in developing a new sedan these days. Luxury cars are a different picture. Luxury sedans will still sell, but mass market vehicles like the ones most of us buy, Chevy Malibus, Ford Fusions, those customers have shifted very much away from sedans toward, build vehicles that are a little bit taller. They look like SUVs, but they don't have all of the mechanical stuff that would allow a Jeep, for instance, to go up the side of a building. So they're not really rugged off-road vehicles. They're kind of like tall station wagons, frankly, and people love them. And they have grown to be over half of the market. In fact, it used to be that sedans and all kinds of trucks, pickups, vans, and SUVs, were about 50-50 as far as their proportion of sales. Last year, trucks were over 70%. Sedans had fallen to just 30, and they're falling even more this year. And that's why companies like Toyota, Honda, Nissan, that already sold lots of sedans and had a very strong image for the sedans they sold, vehicles like Accords and Camrys, they can continue to justify developing them. But if you were a company like General Motors or Ford that sold at a lower margin because you had squandered the opportunity to have as good a reputation in sedans, frankly, as Toyota and Honda do. The margin's just not there. It's better for you to go to the part of the market where you can make more money.
I'm Kirk Heinze, and my guest is Mark Phelan, auto critic for the Detroit Free Press. Mark, before we get more into the electrification, which we've talked about in the past, and connected and autonomous, a lot of people are wondering, what's the deal on moving the auto show from the traditional, iconic January dates to June?
Oh, that's a huge change, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it works out. This past January was the last time that the Detroit Auto Show, which is also the North American International Auto Show, will be held in January, which had been the dates for pretty much all of my lifetime anyway, and it's moving to June. A couple of things drove it. There's increasing competition from other from venues in addition to automakers, to auto shows, for where companies should introduce new vehicles. Facebook, you know, Twitter, a lot of online stuff, and you know, event companies doing an event where just their vehicle is being introduced, so they're not fighting with, you know, 10 other vehicles for attention. So that's reduced the amount of business that all the big established auto shows get. On top of that, car companies want things where want events where people can get involved with the vehicles in different ways. Because if you're just walking around the floor of an auto show, there's not much that you get that way. They're afraid there's not much benefit to that that's more than what you would get if you were just watching it on your computer at home. So what they want is things they call activations, things where you can get into the car, where you can feel it, where you can, you know, move around in it, where you can experience the new technology. And January in Detroit doesn't really lend itself to quick test drives, and let's just step outside the building for a minute. June, perfect. So what they're going to do, they'll have, you know, an outdoor off-roading park, basically, that they're planning on building in front of Cobo Center, where you'll be able to take SUVs, you know, up, you know, steep hills and things like that. They'll probably have an area where you'll be able to be driven around in an autonomous vehicle. They'll be able to demonstrate all the new technologies better, and that's what the automakers want, and the automakers pay the bills, frankly, for the auto show. So if you give them more of what they want, you have a better auto show. And if they like, you know, the setup, they bring more of the vehicles that, you know, make lots of news, the big splashy introductions of and unveilings of new vehicles. That brings press from around the world, and that's good for, you know, the local economy. So that's basically the thinking behind it. Nobody knows yet how the first one is going to go. Every auto show in the world has been complaining, oh, those nasty Twitters are taking away our business. It's terrible. What are we going to do? And none of them have done anything. So whether it turns out to be a brilliant move or not, I've got to give the organizers of the Detroit Auto Show credit for at least doing something. They hit the reset button, and they're trying something different, and we'll see how it works.
I have to ask, I'm thinking about young people. A lot of them are using Lyft and Uber and don't even care about owning cars, but how much of this experiential need to get your butt into the seat of a car, how much of that is being driven by the younger generation, the millennials, for example?
Oh, very much. The millennials are a huge driver of that kind of thing, and also of all the new technologies, because we think of getting into a car and, you know, we think we're just going for a test drive, but they may want to, you know, see how quickly does their phone pair, how well does their phone work with it. Increasingly, when you're talking about vehicles people will be driven in rather than driving themselves, they want to see other amenities. What have you got in the back seat? What's the Wi-Fi situation? All of those things. So The customer base is changing fairly drastically as we move from a model where in America you could assume most people used their own car all the time to one where it'll be on demand.
We're talking cars with Mark Phelan, well-respected auto critic and writer for the Detroit Free Press. While we're on the subject of millennials and what have you, as we're looking ahead to 2019 and beyond, connected autonomous vehicles, we talked about it last year. Frankly, when you talk to a lot of people, I mean, nothing seems to animate people's biases any more than discussing autonomous and connected vehicles. Even people who tend to be fairly progressive about technology in general can't imagine being in a driverless car. Where are we with all of this in terms of connected, autonomous, and shared vehicles?
It's getting closer every day, and it's probably a lot closer than you think. General Motors is absolutely adamant that they will have self-driving vehicles in taxi service in the heart of some major American city this year. Mm. And it will be an operating commercial service. It won't just be a test program. If they do that, that's a huge milestone. Autonomous vehicles, it's funny because some people talk about it like within 2 years, everybody's going to be in an autonomous vehicle. That's couldn't be farther from the truth. What we're going to see is a migration, and it'll be 40 or 50 years before every vehicle on the road is capable of autonomy, and there will probably be many that people still have the option of driving themselves. But if you think about delivery services, if you think about just taxis and shuttles, if you think about the fact, one of the things that has always stuck with me is that my 92-year-old aunt in Dublin, if she can walk 50 meters from her house to a bus stop, she can be anywhere in Ireland within 2 hours. And she doesn't have a car because there's a public transportation network. In America, for a million reasons, we don't have that. But autonomous vehicles can fill that gap, I think, for a lot of people who have, you know, restricted mobility, whether it's because they're too young, too old, physical reasons. I think it will tremendously increase the autonomy and the quality of life, frankly, for a lot of people who would not be able to get around and do the things they need. And that is one of the areas that we'll see relatively quickly. We'll see some more wealthy areas setting up their own geofenced services so that if you live in Birmingham, Michigan, for instance, you know, the city may have a small fleet of autonomous vehicles that will pick you up at your house and take you to the restaurant or the optometrist or anything like that, and it'll grow. It's important that it become available to everybody, but I really think that, you know, it's a great opportunity, but you don't want to assume that it's happening overnight because it won't.
Whenever, as you know, historically you roll out new technologies, there are going to be some tragedy sometimes associated with that. There was the death of that pedestrian, I believe, down in Arizona. Those things are going to be setbacks, but you don't see them as barriers that are going to impede the progress of connected autonomous.
I hope they don't, because the systems should lead to an almost infinitely safer transportation network. It's impossible for us as humans not to focus on the one terrible thing where a person died. But the number of people who are killed in the whole country every year in, you know, vehicle accidents is, you know, 40,000 odd, I believe. And we've got a real spike in the number of pedestrians that are being killed. That's been going up steadily over the years, while, you know, car-to-car accident fatalities has actually gone down. One of the things that really full-level autonomous vehicles should be able to do is almost eliminate that. I mean, there will always be some true accidents where everything goes wrong and somebody, you know, gets injured or killed. But the number of it, it's like airlines, frankly. I mean, you know, there's pilot error and there's computer error. And pilot error is more common than computer error. And we're moving toward a day when the same thing will be true in vehicles. And if we can just, you know, make sure that, you know, they can, that every vehicle can sense the person in front of it, that would be a huge, you know, step. And that's something that's relatively close. Those systems will be widespread and on almost every vehicle long before full autonomy takes place. They'll be, you know, put in the guise of systems that help a driver. And I shouldn't have said in the guise, because they will help the driver. They will make sure that, you know, if your attention wanders, that, you know, something stops you before you hit the kid on the tricycle.
And of course, closely associated with autonomous and connected is electrification. Where is electrification headed? The Volt is no more, but the Bolt is still, and there are more electrified vehicles choices than ever before. You still optimistic about the future of electric?
More so every day. I have to real quickly just, you know, do a little elegy for the Volt, and that's Volt with a V, not Bolt with a B. General Motors did not do us any favors with those two names, but the Volt was brilliant. It was a breakthrough, and I was talking to one of the chief engineers, you know, recently, and we had spoken a lot while the vehicle was being developed, and I said to her, you know, I feel like somebody that we both used to work with just died, and she said, well, I understand that, but really, the Volt achieved its purpose. We built it to convince people that they didn't have to be worried about range anxiety, that you didn't have to worry about batteries, getting an electric car and being stranded when all you were trying to do was go to the grocery store and back. And we succeeded more quickly than we expected, and we were able to introduce the Bolt with a B, which can go 240 miles on a charge, quickly enough that it superseded the Volt. So the technology is moving very quickly, and while autonomy is a long way away, I think electric vehicles in meaningful mass production volumes and at prices that normal people can afford. In fact, we have a reasonable number of them at prices normal people can afford today. Hyundai, Chevrolet, mass market brands selling some very good electric vehicles. And I think we're going to see more and more of those. It looks like potentially the big inflection point is going to be around 2021-22. That seems to be when a lot of the programs that mass market brands have in place should begin to, you know, put meaningful numbers of these vehicles, you know, in the hands of normal people.
Well, I like to brag. I've had my Volt since 2012, and I've averaged 104.3 miles per gallon over 80,000 miles. So I've been very pleased with it. Mark, let's step away from automotive for a minute. I mentioned your Spartan pedigree. You're a proud graduate of the MSU School of Journalism. The profession has been under vitriolic attack, to say the least, including from some of the highest offices in the land. Where do you see the state of the profession and along with that, advice you might give to young people who are either preparing for a career in journalism or thinking about a career in journalism?
Well, I think, first of all, the state of the profession in many ways is terrific. The quality of the work that's being done is great. And that's in part because there are huge, massive issues that are very polarizing and things that are affecting how we define ourselves as a people in pretty profound ways. And that kind of thing demands more work, demands more coverage, and also generates more passion on both sides. It's really strange, I have to say, as a journalist, to hear direct attacks on the press coming from, you know, the highest offices in the land. That seems like the kind of thing, that's the kind of thing that I'm used to hearing about in totalitarian countries, not in America. You know, in America, they assumed that, you know, this is part of the job. It's a free society. You know, people, you know, will say and print what they want, and they will try to find out all they can. So that's a huge change, but it's But the questions that underlie and go along with all of that have led to great journalism from a lot of, you know, places, and they have got people more involved. I mean, you know, the level of passion that surrounds everything from immigration policy to tailpipe emissions standards is much greater. People are much more engaged, and it's sad because that engagement comes when people are arguing passionately about both sides of it, and where there's a chance that things could go badly off the rails. But people are energized, and it feels like this is in some ways part of what goes with being the communicators in a free society. You know, you do your best to tell the story, and there are some people who are, you know, going to hate you for it.
And so the young folks who are in journalism schools like at Michigan State or thinking about it, they're in high schools working on the school newspaper or the school blog or whatever they have these days in high schools. And what advice would you have for them?
First of all, it's the I can't imagine a better, you know, way to have spent my professional life. It's great, but it's hard, and there's a lot of, for every job that is, you know, flying around the world, you know, covering big international events, or, you know, sitting down with the heads of, you know, global automakers and talking about them with them about strategy and you know, the fate of the world's environment. There are 100 jobs that are just as important to, you know, filling the newspaper and keeping the radio waves, you know, full of information that look less glamorous. So I think that, you know, if this is something that you feel like you have to do. If this is the thing that you were made to do, this is what makes you happy, don't let anything talk you out of it. But if you're just, you know, thinking, you know, it'd be nice to be on TV, you know, it'd be great if, you know, people recognized me, you know, when I went to the grocery store, that's not the reason to get into it. And honestly, it's not that great when people recognize you at the grocery store. I mean, there have been any number of times when I was, you know, wearing a ratty old MSU sweatshirt and, you know, a pair of sweatpants, and I was just stopping in to get something quickly, and somebody recognizes me from my picture in the paper, and I think, man, I really should dress better. But it's a great way to make a living, and the fact that it's so much easier for people to get information these days, and the fact that there's a greater appetite for information than ever before, I think makes this a terrific time for it. And one of my biggest hopes is that, you know, as I look at, you know, people who have grown up with, you know, this, you know, wealth of information available, is that they're better at recognizing the people who are just coming out to, you know, push their point of view, and the people who are generating stories that are clearly false or misrepresenting the truth. And if you grew up in a world where Google gives you 10 answers to every question that you ask about the news, you know that you should check several and figure out which are the ones that make sense and which are the ones that are just, you know, trying to, you know, whip up emotion. And you know, I really believe that we're in a phase where there's a big part of the population that didn't grow up with this, and they're way too likely to believe the one thing they saw on Facebook as if it was, you know, Walter Cronkite when he was the most trusted man in the world on CBS News saying it, and it's not the same. You've got to be a smart consumer of information.
Yeah, misinformation and false information. There still has to be some guardian of the truth, and journalism is it, I think, these days in particular.
Absolutely. And I mean, I can say the people that I work with they feel that trust. They feel that, you know, the thing that has been entrusted to them, telling people what's going on and figuring out what are the things that, you know, that people need to know. What are the stories that maybe won't be popular, but it's important that we tell it. It's important, and one of the things that makes me happy is that the people I know who do it take it seriously.
So journalists will, and Mark Phelan, Spartans will as well. Seeking the truth. It's been a pleasure once again talking with Detroit Free Press auto critic and writer Mark Phelan. Mark, after several telephone interviews in the past, to meet face-to-face is an especial pleasure.
It has been great, Kirk. Thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it and how much I look forward to the next time we talk, whether it's in person or by phone.